virus database has been updated.
Portland School Board hearing at a community design team's plan to improve student achievement and enrollment at the North Portland High School and the schools that feed into it. Superintendent Vicki Phillips opened the meeting by presenting standardized test scores for Jefferson High and Ockley Green and Tubman Middle Schools that showed their performance ranks near the bottom of all Oregon schools. Under the plan, uniforms would be required of all high school students in the Jefferson neighborhood. As at previous meetings, most who spoke highlighted uniforms and the single-sex academies as proposals that would encourage segregation and worsen declining enrollment. The Jefferson Parent Teacher Student Association presented an alternative set of recommendations that included maintaining a school-wide 9th through 12th grade structure with enhanced arts, technology, and college preparatory programs. This from the Oregonian.
Continued heavy rainfall atop saturated ground has prompted officials to post warnings along the Willamette River for people to avoid contact with the water. Diluted raw sewage overflowed into the river at the Union Street diversion structure early this morning. This from the Salem Statesman Journal. Signs were set to go up today due to potentially high levels of bacteria. The signs will be removed once the bacteria levels return to normal. Concerned Oregonians ought to be asking elected representatives and city officials why this continues to be a problem when most Oregonians are aware that winter means rain.
Yesterday was the official launch for Portland Project Homeless Connect. It's a revolutionary program putting together medical, dental, legal, addiction, and housing counseling services for Portlanders experiencing homelessness. Hundreds of service providers, officials, and volunteers converged on the Oregon Convention Center for the opening. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Philip Mangano, director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, who is in town for the opening festivities.
Sir, can you tell us how is it that this project is unique? What do other city centers do with their homelessness issues?
Sure. Well, first of all, what's important to understand that what is happening today in Portland, that is Project Homeless Connect, which is bringing together a wide array of housing and benefit and employment and health services all under one roof, and then inviting both people from the community and homeless people to gather together to make those resources impact the lives of people who are sleeping out on the streets or sleeping long-term in the shelters. That effort is being replicated in about 30 cities all over our country. So it's an idea that came about in San Francisco and is now spreading, and part of our work in Washington with the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness is to take these good ideas that are showing results, and Project Homeless Connect in cities all across our country have shown the result of moving homeless people off the streets, out of long-term shelter stays, into housing, into health care, into jobs, into better treatment. So what's working in the rest of the country today is working right here in Portland. There are about 300 volunteers here. About 600 homeless people have come to access the services. And it's literally a one-stop where homeless people can come and get legal issues and treatment issues and, again, housing and benefit and employment issues all met under one roof. That is unique for homeless people, and it's will demonstrate that strategy works in the lives of homeless people. There will be homeless people today who will no longer be homeless. There will be homeless people today who will come in off the streets. There will be homeless people today who will decide to go into treatment. That's a good thing for your streets. It's a good thing for your neighborhoods, and it's an especially good thing for those homeless people.
That was KBOO's Lisa Loving. For more information on Project Homeless Connect, go to www.portlandhomelessconnect.com.
Concerns that Oregon is actively recruiting illegal immigrants to receive services has prompted an inquiry from a state legislator. House Representative Linda Flores is asking Department of Human Services officials to explain their participation with the Mexican consulate's mobile outreach program. Although the Mexican government issues identification cards at these events, Oregon state agencies offer information and resources. The Clackamas Republican plans to question other state agencies about their involvement. Jim Ludwig, the president of Oregonians for Immigration Reform, said the state should not be doing outreach in light of budget restraints. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Budget analysts recommend that Oregon lawmakers hold off this week on big steps to fill the $168 million hole in the state human services budget. But they also said lawmakers should get ready for a potential special session later. The Legislative Emergency Board will consider the report at its regular meeting Thursday and Friday. Governor Ted Kulongoski and the legislature's presiding officers are agreed on only one point: no immediate special session of the full legislature. They also say they do not want to slash services or raise taxes to make up the shortfall. The report by the Legislative Fiscal Office does recommend that the E-Board go ahead with $12.6 million in administrative savings and other cost-cutting steps proposed by the Department of Human Services. However, the agency's request for $168 million far exceeds the $19 million projected in the state emergency fund. The request differs slightly from the $172 million shortfall previously reported. Analysts recommend that by March 1st, agency officials come up with proposals to cut or change services, either by agency or legislative action. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported yesterday that CNN's Headline News has hired Glenn Beck for a primetime program. Media Matters for America has compiled some of Beck's more notable comments. Beck is a nationally syndicated radio host known for making controversial statements. In disclosures from a caller who claimed to have tortured prisoners in U.S. custody, quote, "I've got to tell you, I appreciate your service. Good for you. Good for you. Is it because you did it for the country? I have to tell you, when all is said and done, I'm glad people like you are on our side." News of Beck's hiring follows a recent report that CNN has hired radio host and former Reagan administration Secretary of Education Bill Bennett, who said in September, "You could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down." This after a CNN report alleged that Iran was pursuing nuclear weapons when in fact President Ahmadinejad had said his nation was developing nuclear technology.
A group of religious leaders has sent a complaint to the Internal Revenue Service requesting an investigation of two large churches in Ohio. They say the churches are improperly campaigning on behalf of a conservative Republican running for governor. In their complaint, the clergy members contend that the two Columbus area churches, Fairfield Christian Church and the World Harvest Church, which were widely credited with getting out the Ohio vote for President Bush in 2004, have allowed their facilities to be used by Republican organizations, promoted the candidate J. Kenneth Blackwell among their members, and otherwise violated prohibitions on political activity by tax-exempt groups. They are asking the IRS to examine whether the church's tax exemption should be revoked and are requesting that Mark W. Everson, the federal tax commissioner, seek an injunction to stop what they consider improper activities. Both churches denied that any of their activities violated limitations on nonprofit political activity. This from the New York Times.
House Republican leaders laid out a proposal today to rewrite constitutional rules governing lobbying as they tried to limit the political damage from an election year scandal over undue influence and access afforded to lobbyists. In the first of a series of competing initiatives, House Speaker Dennis Hastert called for a ban on congressional travel underwritten by outside groups, tougher restrictions on gifts and favors, and the elimination of privileges for lawmakers turned lobbyists. It is a response to three bribery and corruption convictions that have reached into the House of Representatives. Inquiries related to those criminal acts are continuing. Congressional Democrats plan to issue their own overhaul plan today. Senate Republicans are also preparing one as well in what longtime watchdog described as a bidding war touched off by guilty pleas to corruption charges by the high-powered lobbyist Jack Abramoff and an associate and a House Republican's admission to taking bribes. Though the plans differ in some respects, all take aim at the opportunities available to lobbyists to provide lawmakers with an array of benefits. Democrats plan to push ahead with their own proposals, saying they're skeptical that the Republicans who control the House and Senate will be able to clean up a system that they've presided over. It's like, quote, "It's like asking John Gotti to do what he can do to clean up organized crime," said Senator Harry Reid of Nevada, a Democratic minority leader. This from the Washington Post.
According to the Vermont Guardian, parents cannot remove their children's names from a Pentagon database that includes highly personal information used to attract military recruits. The Pentagon has spent more than $70 million on market research, national advertising, website development, and management of the Joint Advertising Market Research and Studies Database, a storehouse of questionable legality that includes the names and personal details of more than 30 million U.S. children and young people between the ages of 16 and 23. It is a different database than the information collected from schools that receive federal education money. The No Child Left Behind Act requires schools to report the names, addresses, and phone numbers of secondary school students to recruiters. But the law also specifies that parents or guardians may write a letter to the school asking that their children's names not be released. But many parents have reported being surprised that their children are contacted anyway, according to a San Francisco-based coalition called Leave My Child Alone. Parents must contact the Pentagon directly to ask that their children's information not be released to recruiters, but the data is not removed from the database. Instead, the information is moved to a suppression file where it is continuously updated with new data from private and government sources and still made available to recruiters. The database is made using information from state motor vehicles departments, the Selective Service, and data mining firms that collect and organize information from private companies. In addition to names, addresses, social security numbers, and phone numbers, the database may include cell phone numbers, email addresses, grade point averages, ethnicity, and subjects of interest. The Pentagon spends about $500,000 annually to purchase the data from private companies and has paid more than $70 million since 2002 to Mullen Advertising to target recruiters' messages toward teens and young adults. The Boston Business Journal reported in October that the Pentagon had spent a total of $206 million on the program so far and could spend another $137 million over the next 2 years.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell has admitted that mistakes were made in the decision to go to war with Iraq. Powell said, "We were wrong. The intelligence community was wrong. The British intelligence community was wrong. And all the other intelligence communities were wrong. And I presented wrong information because that was the information we believed to be true at the time." In the interview with BBC, Powell admits mistakes, saying the United States made the best decision possible based on information he now says was off target. The reporter asked if he would like to apologize for misleading the war. Powell responded by saying, "I didn't mislead the world when you were presenting what you believed to be fact."
An official assessment drawn up by the U.S. Foreign Aid Agency depicts the security situation in Iraq as dire, amounting to a social breakdown in which criminals have almost free rein. The conflict assessment is an attachment to an invitation to contractors to bid on a project rehabilitating Iraqi cities published earlier this month by the U.S. Agency for International Development. The picture it paints is not only darker than the optimistic accounts from the White House and the Pentagon, it also gives a more complex profile of the insurgency than the straightforward rejectionists, Saddamists, and terrorists described by George Bush. The U.S. aid analysis talks of an internecine conflict involving religious, ethnic, criminal, and tribal groups. Quote, "It is increasingly common for tribesmen to turn in the authorities' enemies as insurgents, or to the authorities' enemies as insurgents. This is as a form of tribal revenge," the paper says, casting doubt on the efficacy of counterinsurgent sweeps by coalition and Iraqi forces. Meanwhile, foreign jihadist groups are growing in strength. The assessment conflicted sharply with recent Pentagon claims that Zarqawi's group was in, quote, disarray. The U.S. aid document was attached to project documents for the Focus Stabilization and Strategic Cities Initiative. The paper, whose existence was first reported by the Washington Post, argues that insurgent attacks, quote, "significantly damage the country's infrastructure and cause a tide of adverse economic and social effects that ripple across Iraq." This, according to The Guardian.
Italian prosecutors investigating the killing of an Italian Secret Service agent at a checkpoint in Iraq plan to charge a U.S. soldier with murder and attempted murder. U.S. gunfire killed Nicola Calipari as the agent was heading to Baghdad airport in a car with an Italian journalist who had just been released after being held hostage by militants. The ANSA and APCOM news agencies reported yesterday that prosecutors planned to charge the soldier with murdering Calipari and attempting to murder the agent driving the car, as well as the journalist, Giuliana Sagrena. Both were wounded during the incident. Pentagon spokesman Barry Venable said the Pentagon had not seen any charges actually filed and declined to comment. The Americans insisted that the car was going fast enough to alarm the soldiers. The Italians have said the vehicle was traveling slowly. police and ballistic experts assigned by Rome prosecutors to examine the car have concluded that it was traveling slower than the U.S. military claimed. They agreed with the U.S. findings that only one soldier fired at the car. The shooting angered Italians, already largely opposed to the war in Iraq, and led many to step up calls for withdrawing the Italian contingent. Premier Silvio Berlusconi, who sent some 3,000 troops to Iraq after Saddam Hussein's ouster, insisted the incident would not affect troop levels or Italy's friendship with Washington.
A neoconservative who occasionally consulted for George Bush's Defense Department has confirmed that he was a contributor to the Italian magazine Panorama, whose reporter first came across the forged documents claiming that Iraq was seeking to obtain uranium from Niger. This from Raw Story. In an email to Raw Story, occasional Bush Foreign Affairs advisor Michael Adeen confirmed that he was, several years ago, a regular contributor to Panorama, but would not provide more specifics. The confirmation of his work with the publication adds yet another dimension to the Niger forgery scandal and possible U.S. government involvement in pre-war intelligence manipulation. Ladine denies that he was involved in the Niger forgeries and says he has no knowledge of the documents or how they came to be provided to the U.S. government. But Ladine confirmed that he wrote for Panorama and worked with the publication's editor-in-chief, Carlo Rossella. A closer look at the series of overlapping relationships and events, however, suggests that Ladine may have been connected, even if inadvertently, to the Niger forgeries. In 2002, Panorama journalist Elisabetta Berba was handed a set of documents purporting to show that Saddam Hussein had purchased 500 tons of yellowcake uranium from Niger. But the documents were later shown to be forgeries, though not before their content had been referenced in Bush's State of the Union address. After investigating the documents for an article and finding them to be suspect, Berba suggested to her editor, Carlo Rossella, that she take a trip to Niger to investigate further. Rossella diverted her to the U.S. Embassy in Rome instead. She never ran the article. Berba dropped off the forgeries to the U.S. Embassy on October 9, 2002. But as Berba was investigating the documents, head of Italian intelligence Niccolo Porrari was meeting with then-Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. The meeting took place in September 2002. And is alleged to be brokered by Ladine. Questioned about the meeting, Hadley has said no one involved in the meeting had, quote, any recollection of a discussion of natural uranium or any recollection of any documents being passed.
With both Russia and China seeking to quiet the crisis over Iran's nuclear program, Vice President Dick Cheney's current visit to the Middle East, where he met with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak yesterday, seems likely to make matters worse. Talk of UN Security Council sanctions against Iraq, supported loudly by some in the U.S. Congress, is playing badly overseas. Sanctions aren't failing just in the Middle East, either. According to the Iraqi press, Cheney was expected to broach the possibility of Egypt sending troops to Iraq as a last resort, along with other units from the countries in the Arab League. Cheney is expected to raise the same idea in Saudi Arabia. The thinking is that Egypt can be drawn into a confrontation with Iran because of its close proximity and because Egypt's leaders would be happy to come down hard against any Shiite radicals working out of Iran and bent on causing trouble in Egypt. The Iraqi government might agree to such a deal in the end run. Egypt has long-standing friendly relations with people in the Iraq guerrilla movement. In addition, helping the U.S., which gives it $2 billion in aid, would be a plus. And there is always the possibility of Egypt and U.S. completing some sort of free trade agreement that would open the U.S. to Egyptian goods. Should the Iran imbroglio go to the U.N., Egypt could operate under the U.N. flag. The countries of the Arab League are against Iran developing nuclear armaments. In other words, dragging Egypt into Iraq might kill two birds with one stone, inserting Egypt as a player in that war and pushing them toward a confrontation with Iran. This from the Village Voice.
The U.S. has refused to hand over to Philippine authorities four U.S. Marines charged with raping a local woman. This from the BBC. The refusal is in line with a treaty between the two sides, which allows the U.S. to keep custody of suspects until judicial proceedings are concluded. The alleged rape took place in November inside a van at Subic Bay, a former U.S. base northwest of the capital, Manila. About 30 protesters chanted anti-U.S. slogans and burned the U.S. flag outside the U.S. Embassy in Manila yesterday, where the soldiers are being held. The Subic Bay authorities said earlier that the alleged victim had been visiting a karaoke bar when she met the Marines, who then reportedly invited her to get into a rented van with them. At least one of them has acknowledged having sex with the 22-year-old, but said it was consensual.
The ruling party in divided Ivory Coast says it's pulling out of both transitional governments and talks on the divided nation's future. This from the BBC. Government supporters held another day of protest at what they see as an interference by the UN in France. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan urged an immediate end to what he called orchestrated violence. But the ruling party's leader said the world had failed in Ivory Coast and that French and UN troops should leave. The BBC's reporter in Ivory Coast's main city, Abidjan, says the protesters now control virtually all the main streets there. In the west of the country, around 1,000 protesters invaded and occupied a UN base in Giglu.
Israel's acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert yesterday held out the prospect of renewed peace talks with the Palestinians in his first main policy statement since assuming the duties of Ariel Sharon. Olmert defended his decision to let Palestinians vote in East Jerusalem, emphasizing its links with a future Palestinian state. But while sending out moderate signals, Olmert also sounded a menacing note on Iran. He is saying that Israel would not allow its enemies to acquire potentially lethal nuclear technology. Ahead of Palestinian and Israeli elections, Olmert is widely considered more amenable to talks with the Palestinian leader, Mahmoud Abbas, than Ariel Sharon. He made it clear that the basis for negotiations would be President Bush's long-stalled roadmap and that such talks would be conditional on the Palestinian Authority abiding by its commitments to disarm Hamas and other militant groups. The remarks were seen by analysts as Olmert trying to emerge from the shadow of Ariel Sharon and establish his own identity. But he surprised many by hinting that Israel might not maintain control forever over the 250,000 Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem. Israel has held East Jerusalem under military occupation since capturing it in the 1967 war, but which Palestinians demand as the capital of their future state. This, according to the Times of London.
If Europeans and the United States succeed in referring Iran's nuclear program to the UN Security Council, sanctions or other enforcement action would be a long way off, if imposed at all. This, according to Reuters. But at a minimum, the West is counting on a political and diplomatic embarrassment for Tehran. This month, Iran removed UN inspection seals on uranium enrichment equipment, deepening suspicions it is seeking nuclear arms. Even if no oil embargo or blanket sanctions are enacted, the Council could impose an arms embargo, a travel freeze on individuals, or a call on countries to reduce diplomatic ties. Other possibilities include granting the IAEA enhanced powers to conduct intrusive inspections in Iran. Council diplomats envision a step-by-step approach that would slowly ratchet up pressure. The first move probably would be an appeal to Iran to abide by recommendations from the Vienna-based International Atomic Energy Agency, which has sent inspectors to Iran. The council would also ask IAEA Director Mohammed El-Baradei to submit a report within a month.
Michelle Bachelet has pledged to make half her cabinet women and give all Chileans a voice following her election as the Catholic nation's first female president. But the socialist pediatrician took a more moderate line than other leftist leaders in Latin America. Bachelet said she would seek to maintain Chile's economic success and that she supported a U.S.-backed free area as long as it took into account the region's diversity. Bachelet, who beat the right-leaning Sebastián Piñera in Sunday's runoff, is the third woman elected president of a Latin American country.
Nigerian freedom fighters who have sabotaged oil facilities and kidnapped workers in the southern Niger Delta threatened yesterday to stage more attacks on the world's eighth largest oil exporter. In an email statement, the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta, which is holding four foreign hostages, also threatened to use more aggressive tactics against oil workers and their families in the vast wetlands region. The militants called on oil workers to leave the region of mangrove swamps and tidal creeks, where almost all of Nigeria's $2.4 million a day is produced. The four hostages kidnapped by the group spoke to Reuters by telephone on their sixth day in captivity. They listed their captors' demands and warned the military against any attempted intervention or rescue. The American, Britain, Bulgarian, and Honduran All said they were being treated well, but that conditions in the steamy, mosquito-prone Delta were tough. Royal Dutch Shell evacuated about 330 workers from four oil flow stations after the latest attack on Sunday and prepared to evacuate more workers amid uncertainty over where the militants will strike next, an industry source said. ExxonMobil denied a report by a shipping agent that it had suspended tanker loadings at two terminals that together export 550,000 barrels per day. The militants demand local control over the Niger Delta's oil wealth, that Shell pay the local government $1.5 billion to compensate for pollution, and the release of three men, including two ethnic leaders, this according to Reuters.
According to Iran's Manorama online news service, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has allowed CNN to resume operating in the country. This after the American cable news network apologized for mistakenly quoting him as saying Tehran was seeking nuclear weapons, state radio reported on Tuesday. During CNN's live translation of a press conference by Ahmadinejad on Saturday, the president was quoted as saying that, "We believe all nations are allowed to have nuclear weapons, and that the West should not, quote, deprive us to have nuclear weapons." The president was, however, using a Farsi word that meant technology and not weapons. CNN said it was very disappointed by the ban, which it admitted was due to a translation error. CNN apologized on all its platforms, which included the translation error, and also expressed its regrets to the Iranian government and the Iranian ambassador to the UN.
Chinese police clubbed a teenage protester to death, and the authorities then bribed her family to keep quiet about the killing, according to the UK's Guardian. This is a violent demonstration by villagers against the forced seizure of land by developers continued into the new year. Fang Miang, aged about 14, was reported to have been fatally beaten when police attempted to break up a protest by several hundred residents of Sanjiao in the southern province of Guangdong. Local residents said the security forces used electric batons and other weapons after the demonstrators blocked a road, threw stones, and smashed up police vehicles. One witness told reporters the authorities switched off the streetlights before the counterattack, which led to several dozen injuries. According to the South China Morning Post, local officials paid Fang's parents nearly $18,000 on condition they told the outside world she died of a heart attack. Other villagers said schoolgirl Fang had been one of the stone throwers. She was reportedly thrashed unconscious after being dragged from underneath a police car. Most of the mainland media have been forbidden from covering the incident.
A Highlands Ranch Republican wants to make it a crime to run away from home. This from the Rocky Mountain News Service in Colorado. Representative Ted Harvey today introduced legislation making running away from home for any child 17 and younger a Class 2 misdemeanor. House Bill 1123 also allows parents to have the charge dismissed the first time a child is charged. That's the KBOO Morning News for Wednesday, January 18th, 2006. Weather for today calls for rain with temperatures in the mid-40s. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM, on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for this morning's newscast is Brian Smith. Our assistant producer is Chris Andre. Our engineer is Boone Rivas. And the morning news and public affairs director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Abe Proctor.
And I'm Carlos Chavez.
Stay tuned for...